consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW, Washington.
Greetings. I'm Askia Muhammad, news director. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Above all, stay alive. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Good morning, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and the rest of our friends and the other parts of the Blue Planet listening to us online. Welcome to Arise on WPFW Washington, D.C., 89.3 on your FM dial. And welcome to those who are joining us via our podcast. It's a overcast, slightly drizzling day here in Washington, D.C. It's a Friday. And as you all know, I always say Fridays are good days. Unfortunately, this Friday we woke up finding out that Boris Johnson and his crew in Britain won a decisive victory in yesterday's elections in Britain. And my only hope, and we're not going to get into this today, is that we discourage those who will look at the defeat of the Labour Party in Britain and try to draw analogies to what the Democratic Party should do in the United States and going up against Trump. We'll probably hear people saying we have to tone things down, not be as antagonistic when we are engaged in a struggle for the future. This week, the Trump administration issued what many people found to be a very strange and very unsettling executive order that is aimed quite clearly at suppressing pro-Palestinian sentiment in the United States and activism, and attempting to, in effect, criminalize those who are critical of Israel and Israel's practices and its oppression of the Palestinians, the occupation and the apartheid system. Today we're going to look at an aspect of this, and I was very inspired by an article I read on one of my favorite online magazines, MondoWeiss.net. And it's an article entitled "Zionism's Uneasy Relationship with Antisemitism." The author is Alice Rothschild, who's a physician, author, and filmmaker who has focused her interest in human rights and social justice on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's practiced OBGYN for almost 40 years and was a professor at Harvard Medical School. She has written and lectured on the issue of Israel and Palestine. And we are really delighted to have her joining us today. And before I bring her on, I found myself, there was this quote in her article that I found absolutely amazing. And I just want to read it to you all. And I want you to guess who wrote, well, it's not a guess, I guess. "National Socialism," which is the name for Nazism, "has no intention of attacking the Jewish people in any way. On the contrary, the recognition of Jewry as a racial community based on blood and not as a religious one leads the German government to guarantee the racial separateness of this community without any limitations. The government finds itself in complete agreement with a great spiritual movement within Jewry itself, the so-called Zionism, with its recognition of the solidarity of Jewry throughout the world and the rejection of all assimilationist ideas. On this basis, Germany undertakes measures that will surely play a significant role in the future in the handling of the Jewish problem around the world. Those are the words of one Reinhard Heydrich, who was one of the principal architects of the Final Solution. But this was written in the 1930s, and it's quoted in a book entitled The Third Reich and the Palestine Question. I found myself thinking about this week when we heard about this executive order. So we're delighted to have you, Dr. Rothschild. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
What is your response to this executive order?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to state what the executive order says. It purports to be combating anti-Semitism on college campuses by using Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So the plan is to withhold federal money from schools that, quote, fail to counter discrimination against Jews. So it falls within the act that prohibits discrimination against race, color, national origin in federal funding. And now this includes anti-Semitism. And the problem is that they're using a definition of anti-Semitism that is much like the one the State Department has prepared, but this one is from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And so in that setting, the definition is very problematic because they look at Israel as what they call a, quote, Jewish collectivity. So, for example, something like denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination by claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor is now being defined as an anti-Semitic statement rather than a political statement. And that's very dangerous. And it's interesting, the guy who actually wrote that definition said he didn't write it to police campus speech. He wrote it for some other plan. So I think equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism is really about targeting Palestinians and people who are their allies and who really understand that Zionism is a racist, white supremacist, settler, colonial enterprise. And this idea that Jews are a race and they need to be protected, as you can see, is a very, very dangerous thing. And also, conflating religious rights with civil rights is also very dangerous. I mean, just think about religious rights and reproductive rights. I mean, these are separate compartments, and I think we have to think about them separately. The other thing is that the trigger for this was the government's opposition to the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. So what this is really about is an attempt to destroy the BDS movement. It's also part of Trump's plan to splinter sort of agonized liberal Democrats from more left-wing Democrats, and it's also playing into his evangelical base. So there's a lot of very, very troubling things going on. In the face of the fact that real anti-Semitic events are actually on the rise, you know, more Jews have died in the past year than the previous years in anti-Semitic attacks. I mean, we do have a problem, but it's not the problem that Trump thinks it is. And also Trump, you know, uses anti-Semitic tropes and says also sort of horrific things about Jews. So he's not a good person to be figuring this thing out.
So let's, for the purposes with our audience, define what is anti-Semitism and where did this other definition of including Israel, explain a little bit more about the origin of that.
Okay, well, the basic description of anti-Semitism is beliefs or behaviors that are bigoted, that have demeaning caricatures that are based in hatred against Jewish people, Jewish organizations, Jewish institutions, solely because they are Jewish. And that's your basic definition of anti-Semitism. But there's also something that goes beyond this, which Judith Butler calls the fugitive forms of anti-Semitism, you know, things like Jews own the banks or Jews control the financial world. Those kind of ideas are also clearly anti-Semitic. It's also anti-Semitic to think that all Jews share a political position or all Jews support Israel or all Jews are the same as Israelis. I mean, anything that stereotypes Jews as having one way of looking at the world is inherently anti-Semitic, and it's nested in white supremacy. And I think we have to be clear that the rise in anti-Semitism these days is part of the rise in white supremacy, the alt-right, the fascist ideologies that we're seeing all over the world. And the belief that Jews are a race just kind of feeds into this kind of thinking. And so I think the idea that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic is born of a discomfort amongst many politicians, thinkers, whatever, with any kind of criticism of Israel. So Israel's supposed to be an exceptional state, and so you can criticize another state for oppressing, you know, an indigenous group or for occupying an area and settling it, but you can't criticize Israel. And that's very problematic because Israel is a state and it should be criticized when it's doing things that are unacceptable. And that's part of being a democracy. You do things and people criticize what you do and you change and you respond. And somehow Israel's being exceptionalized and taken out of that. And people are using the accusation of anti-Semitism to silence, to shame, to slander people. And that's, again, very dangerous for thinking, for political work, and for making Israel a more respectable state.
Now, you point out in your essay that Zionism as a political movement actually began as a largely secular effort in Europe. And I want you to say a little bit about that, but also the relationship between the Zionist movement and colonialism.
So, you know, Herzl was the father of modern Zionism, and he was a totally assimilated secular Jew who was very involved in the idea that, you know, Jews should be assimilated into their countries. And this was all going on in Europe at the time. And then with the Dreyfus Affair and with more and more anti-Semites being elected to positions in the government in Austria, he sort of turned on that and decided that, you know, anti-Semitism is eternal and that the only solution for, quote, the Jewish problem was to get out of Europe and to have a safe place to go. But the folks that he assembled in the first Zionist Congress in 1897 were secular people. They weren't religious people, and they weren't doing this for religious reasons. They were doing this because they saw it as how Jews could survive. But they mirrored their plans on British colonialism. So their initial idea was to find some neutral place and be, you know, protected by Britain and to set up some kind of colonial enterprise where the indigenous peoples would either be removed or they would be colonized and, quote, improved by, Western European thought, and that this would become a place for Jews to live. And so the sort of religious side of this only took hold when they realized that Palestine was a really good spot for this, and they could use biblical teachings and the beliefs of religious Jews to justify choosing Palestine. But they weren't religious people in themselves. And in fact, Ben-Gurion thought that religiosity would kind of fade away once all the Jews moved to Israel because they wouldn't have to be religious anymore, which is why he gave the rabbis so much power, because he thought that they would kind of die out, which is exactly the opposite of what happened.
And one of the elements of Zionism that I find is not discussed very much in the United States, but you really help put it all together, is what was represented by Vladimir Jabotinsky, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And this right-wing Zionism that entertained relationships with fascism. And I think many of our listeners may find that unbelievable.
Right. I mean, you know, I grew up with the idea that, you know, Zionism was this wonderful national movement for Jews, and it was all like, you know, people in kibbutzes and doing social, you know, Israeli dancing. And, you know, I had no idea that there's this whole other underside of Zionism, which is this revisionist Zionism, which is the forerunner of the Likud party. So I think the reason it's important to talk about this is it helps explain how we got where we are. So Jabotinsky was a reactionary person. He supported settler colonialism and, you know, the sort of militaristic core of Zionism. He snuggled up to Mussolini. He admired Hitler. I mean, he was not a progressive person in any sense of the word. And he was also had a lot of what I would consider self-hatred. He talked about, quote, the typical Yid, which is the Yiddish word for Jew, in very, very derogatory terms, and saw what the cure for this disease would be is, you know, going to Palestine, working the land, carrying the gun, and becoming a militant, bronzed, muscular Jew, and sort of throwing off the pale Torah scholar. So he had very, very profoundly, what I would think, anti-Semitic attitudes towards Eastern European Jews, Torah scholars, et cetera, et cetera. And he really snuggled up with Mussolini and spoke very fondly of fascism, had a newspaper called The Diary of a Fascist. I mean, he thought, you know, he is clearly of the fascistic political bent. And he only turned against the Nazis when they started doing the death camp.
And why, this is sort of a tangential question, but your essay just made me think a lot about this. I remember watching, I've watched several times this incredible film, I'm sure you've seen, Conspiracy, that Kenneth Branagh did about the Wannsee meeting that launched.
I haven't seen it. Yeah.
It's one of the most gripping films I think I've ever seen. And there's no action sequences, but you're just sitting there watching these men plan this annihilation. But Reinhard Heydrich, the character played by Kenneth Branagh, starts the meeting by basically saying, emigration is over. No one will take the Jews. And I was thinking about that in terms of what you were, the quote that you had from Heydrich earlier. And I didn't appreciate that, if I'm understanding correctly, that part one of the Nazis' idea was actually just to move the Jews out of Germany.
Right. So that's where there's this really weird alliance between Zionists and Nazis, which is that the Zionists wanted to move the Jews out of Europe to Palestine, and the Nazis wanted to get rid of the Jews in Europe, so they were happy for them to go to Palestine. So there is this time when the goals of the Nazis and the goals of the Zionists were actually parallel, you know, for obviously very different reasons. And then the Nazis flipped and decided that they didn't want to do immigration and expulsion anymore. And it probably was, I don't know enough Nazi history to know how that happened, but I think the profoundly anti-Semitic views of Nazis and also the fact that most countries were not exactly welcoming Jews and whatever other political machinations were going on in Hitler's head led to the whole idea that Jews needed to be murdered rather than exported.
So over the last, particularly since the Six-Day War in 1967, it seems like there has been this increased tendency to treat criticisms of Israel, of the occupation, of internal apartheid, as representative of anti-Semitism, and that what we're looking at right now is just sort of the crowning of this, making this tendency that has been in operation for decades now more along the lines of the official discourse of the United States.
Right. I mean, what we see is this evolution where there is a conflation of Jews, Judaism, Israel, Zionism, and they're all kind of lumped in one box. And what I contend is that that is really a very muddled thinking, that Jews are a collection of people. They live all over the world. They speak a lot of different languages. They have a lot of different cultures, but they share some religion, some culture, some history, some aspiration, something that clumps them together. You know, Israel is a country, and thus it should be treated as a country. Zionism is a political movement, which is separate from the other two. I mean, you really need to think clearly about all these things because we see what happens when you lump them all together. And Judaism is a religion, obviously. And a religion is different than a people, and it's different than a country, and it's different than a national movement. So, you know, I think the thinking is very muddled and dangerous.
So we're speaking today, and last night the Tories, the Conservative Party in Britain, defeated the Labour Party, led by Jeremy Corbyn. And Corbyn was attacked as being an alleged anti-Semite. And it was interesting in the last weeks before the election, there were certain prominent Jews in Britain that attacked him for this. And I found it very curious because when we look at Boris Johnson, we look at someone who is an active racist and yeah. and has propagated in his Brexit work and others racism, but many of the same people that were going after Corbyn were silent about Boris Johnson, and that seems a similar pattern in the United States where
exactly.
the pro-Palestinian forces are attacked as anti-Semitic when right-wing populists and fascists are it's a heyday for them.
Absolutely. How I mean, I think they're it? Parallel. How do I what?
Explain it. Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that populists and right-wingers and alt-right people have fascistic beliefs, and anti-Semitism is used to shut up discourse they don't want. And so there's a very close alliance between the U.S. government and Israel. There's a huge military-industrial complex between these two countries. You know, Israel has been very useful for American foreign policy. I mean, first of all, you have to also look at after the Nazi Holocaust, there was a huge amount of world guilt. And so people sort of fell over themselves trying to support Israel so the Jews could have a safe place to live, all at the same time not welcoming them in their own backyard. So there is anti-Semitism in all these countries as well. But Israel had a useful role during the Cold War, you know, as a bulwark against Egypt and its alliance with the Soviet Union. Israel was the U.S.'s foot in the door to the oil-rich countries. Israel has after 9/11 was the U.S.'s little sister fighting terrorism. I mean, Israel is useful to the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is also very useful to Israel. And between that and the whole military-industrial connections there, and also the idea, I mean, we're both white settler colonial countries. So there is that, Israel's the villa in the jungle, civilizing the savages, just like, you know, when America was founded, you know, it's the same, it's a parallel manifest destiny kind of mythology. So with all these parallels and with all the financial and military connections and the political usefulness, people in power don't want criticism of Israel to become, a mainstream kind of idea. And the problem is that the Israeli government has a history of dispossessing Palestinians, a brutal occupation, racism towards non-Jewish citizens, racism towards Jewish Israelis who are from Arab countries. I mean, it's a country. It does good things. It does bad things. It needs to be criticized when it is really on the wrong track, and it's on a lot of wrong tracks. So the powers that be don't want that discourse because they want to preserve, quote, the special relationship, which is very deep, and a lot of it is related to surveillance and security and weaponry and all the things that we don't talk about. And it's also related to our mutual mythologies about our wonderful beginnings.
Let me ask you one final question, but it's a big one. So how do we push back, particularly given the efforts at in state legislatures, which I didn't mention in the beginning, efforts in Congress, and now Trump's antics? How do we push back against this? Because it's not just the Jewish Zionists that are propagating the idea of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but we have this whole wave, a large block of so-called Christian Zionists that are propagating this. So how do we counterattack?
Well, and I think we need to remember that there are many, many more Christian Zionists than Jewish Zionists. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, it is difficult. There's a multi-million-dollar industry that is working to create Israel messaging. And a lot of this is around attacking the BDS movement. So we have to, first of all, acknowledge how challenging this is. I think the first thing people need to do is to get educated. That knowledge, in this sense, is power. And that in this day and age, with the internet, with alternative news sources, with social media, there is a growing awareness that something is wrong, and it's seriously wrong. And you can find out what's going on if you want to. It just takes a small amount of effort. The other thing is that Palestinian civil society has called for a boycott, divestment, sanctions of Israel. And I think we have to take that movement extremely seriously, which is, you know, when I see how much pushback there is, it means to me that it must be pretty threatening and effective if it's causing such a pushback. I think the other thing is, this has arisen in the last decade, is the whole concept of intersectionality, that other oppressed peoples like African Americans in the U.S. are now recognizing Palestinians as their sisters and brothers in a common struggle against racism, that cities where the police are being trained in Israel by the Army of Occupation are now recognizing that bringing those tactics and that weaponry into our inner cities is killing the young men and women that live there. So there is a huge amount of intersectional work that is growing that broadens this movement. I think it's very important not to exceptionalize Israel, but to nest it within larger struggles against apartheid, against colonial regimes, against racism. You know, it's not something that is exceptional. It has it is nested in intersectionality and progressive struggles all around the world, and I think that gives this power. But I don't think we should underestimate how difficult this is and what the array of forces are against us. I mean, just today, I mean, it is 5 o'clock in the morning where I am, but I was reading Mondelez. Already there has been moved by a congressman to go after university funding because of, quote, you know, it's hostile Middle East department. You know, this is already happening, and it's like the day after the executive order. So I think we're up against a huge mountain, but I think we have a lot of very important tools and, you know, powerful leaders.
Dr. Rothschild, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Arise, and also thank you especially for the piece that you wrote for Mondo Weiss. It was really, I've read it a couple of times now and just get something out of it each time. And very, very, very strong piece. And for the listeners, again, it's Zionism's Uneasy Relationship with Anti-Semitism by Dr. Alice Rothschild. And I just want to thank you for joining us on Arise.
Well, thank you.
Take care and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
And we are going to take a quick break, and then when we get back, we have a very interesting discussion, not that the last one wasn't interesting, about the issue of breastfeeding, the formula industry, and race. And it all focuses on these quadruplets, these black quadruplets. And it's really an amazing story. So don't go anywhere unless you're running to get your wallet so that you can go online while you're listening to our program and make a contribution to WPFW at WPFWFM.org. But you're listening to Arise on WPFW, Washington, D.C., 89.3 on your FM dial, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Joseph Green, and this is your WPFW social justice calendar for the Washington metro area. Monday, December 16th, the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition will host its second community holiday party. Maceo and friends will provide songs, raise a glass, and celebrate our fight for justice, 7 to 9 p.m. at BFW 8110 Fenton Street, Silver Spring, walkable from Metro. For more information, send email to nofearcoalition@aol.com. Thursday, December 19th, Ukrainian artist and scientist Dr. Olga Zabarskaya will speak at the closing reception of Art Impact International Chroma, international juried art exhibition about Mind Booster Art, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at Pepco Edison Place Gallery, 702 8th Street Northwest. For more information and to register for this free event, visit artimpactinternational.org/chroma or call 202-297-3040. For an online listing of these events, or if you like your social justice event included in the social justice calendar, visit the page ips-dc.org/social justice calendar, where you will find submission guidelines. The Social Justice Calendar is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
And we're back. Welcome again to Arise. This is WPFW Washington, D.C., 89.3 on your FM dial. And I'm Bill Fletcher, your host. So, you know, every so often people, publishers will send me a book or contact me about an author, either for me to write a review or to have them on our program. And I received this email a few weeks ago about this book, and I was very curious about it because of the way it was described. So the book is called Skimmed, Breastfeeding Race and Injustice by Dr. Andrea Freeman. And so it was sent to me, and I started reading it, and I basically couldn't stop. And I kept talking with my wife about it when I was reading it, different sections. And when I was finished, I was just furious and sad about the issues that were raised in this book, and just felt like, well, we absolutely have to have Dr. Freeman on. Now, Dr. Freeman is a professor, an associate professor at the University of Hawaii. And why that's important is that she got up at Hawaii time to join us. So this is not a pre-recorded interview, and I'm forever in her debt. She teaches at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the university, and she researches and writes on issues of race, food policy, health, and consumer credit. She pioneered the theory of food oppression, which examines how partnerships between the government and corporations lead to racial and gender health disparities. Dr. Freeman, welcome to Arise.
Thank you so much, and that is an extremely kind introduction.
Well, I have the benefit of telling the truth, and it's this is not blowing smoke. This book, I'm going to insist that my wife and my daughter read it, and I wanted to have this on today because I was really moved. This book starts in a discussion of about these four quadruplets. Well, obviously, quadruplets are four. That.
Yeah.
So the Fultz, F-U-L-T-Z quadruplets, I'd never heard of. And their story is an incredible tragedy. And you use this story to tell an even more tragic story, but a story that people have to understand. So can you just, what's the basic story behind these quadruplets?
Okay. Their mother was Black and Cherokee. She lived in North Carolina. She had six kids already, and she couldn't hear or speak since childhood. So she actually thought that she was having triplets, and she went to the hospital early because she lived in a very remote area, and this was possibly dangerous for her, and she waited it out in the hospital until they were born. When they came, it turned out that there was one sister hiding behind the others, and she gave birth to the first recorded Black identical quadruplets, I think, anywhere in the world. So this made them into instant celebrities. And her doctor, who was a white doctor, very racist, he had, different waiting rooms, he loved Hitler, he was unapologetically racist. He was also very interested in vitamin C experiments. So he sees this opportunity to use the babies to do his experiments on. So that was the thing he did as soon as they were born. Right after that, he decided that he was going to name these babies for himself. So even though she had picked out names a few times, he named them all with the first name Mary, and then after his wife, daughter, mother, and aunt. After that, he decided that he was going to auction them off to the highest bidding formula company to use for their promotional materials. And that was the first time that formula had ever been marketed to Black women.
I want us to just stop there for a second. Mm-hmm. One, to make an observation and then ask a question. This doctor wasn't simply a racist. This guy was a fascist. I mean, he sounds like Mengele, from the concentration camps. I mean, I'm reading this in absolute horror that this, what he was doing, and that he was getting away with it. But my question is, I have a couple of questions, many questions. One question, though, is why would the formula industry be interested in black folks?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't they be trying to figure out how to move this among white folks?
So they were doing that, but there was a lot of movement around this time from people saying, hey, there is a kind of million-billion-dollar market here that's being untapped, because marketing in general was incredibly racist, and people were only marketing things like cigarettes and alcohol and beauty products to black people. So this provided an opportunity to open up the market and to do an experiment, and it was incredibly successful.
I think one of the things I want you to double underline, the doctor, in effect, stole these children from the parents.
Yes.
How did he do it?
It did get worse.
Well, tell us, how did he do this?
What happened is by making this contract with Pet Milk, which is the company that won, he was able to maintain control over the girls' lives. One of the deals that was part of the contract was that they would have a nurse. And the nurse was somebody chosen by Dr. Klenner. So the nurse made sure that the girls followed all his instructions. He didn't want them playing with other kids, even their own siblings. And they were brought in for check-ins all the time. Then when the girls turned 6 and they were kind of around elementary school age, he went to a judge, and he asked the judge to make the nurse the guardian of the girls. And the judge said yes. The nurse took them away from their parents, and they never lived with their family again.
Now, their lives, and they died relatively young, which I don't...
You're making it sound so sad. It's not only sad.
Yeah. Let me explain. When I looked at the cover of the book, I said, these kids look like they could be from my family.
Mm-hmm.
So this felt very personal.
Yeah.
But it also just reminded me of the manipulation that has been used in marketing and entertainment, et cetera, when it comes to African Americans. So I felt like this was more than just what you were covering, but you covered it very well. I want you to talk a little bit about the specific issue of breastfeeding, because I think you really did. It was very, very important in terms of the way that breastfeeding itself is treated racially. And if you could just delve into that a little bit.
Yeah. So, of course, that started in slavery, isn't it? Country where black women were forced to stop nursing their own children and to nurse white children, and all that system was brutally enforced, like all of slavery, through separating children, through terrible stereotypes about black women as mothers, and all of that continued even after emancipation. Most black women had to work in domestic labor, and they continued to nurse white children. And there has always been a very large gap in breastfeeding between black mothers and children and every other group. And my studies have shown that it is not to do with class, as many people would say. Well, that's just about being poor or not having as much employment and that kind of thing. But there are Latinas in this country who, with the same poverty levels, that have very high breastfeeding rates. So this is very specific to black women and their particular history.
Say a little bit more about that history.
Okay. So we, as I said, starting in slavery, and I think there is a lot of feeling of rejection of the way things were then, and a claiming of people's own bodies and freedom, which could, a part of that could be saying, I'm not going to if I don't want to. But there's also a lot of external stereotyping and assumptions about Black women and whether they're going to breastfeed or not. And that is also, that is racial stereotyping. So Black women get treated differently when they're in hospitals. They get treated differently in doctor's offices. There's always this assumption that they're not going to want to breastfeed. And then there are external forces that make it more difficult. So hospitals in Black neighborhoods do not help as much. They don't have as many resources for, you know, nursing is not easy. It's something that you need to be taught. It doesn't just happen naturally, even though it's portrayed as something very natural. There are neighborhoods that Kimberly Seals Allers calls first food deserts.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Black cities don't have the kind of clinics and the kind of support you would need after you get out of the hospital. So there are all these factors at play that put many obstacles in the way of Black women breastfeeding, but they become rendered invisible by stereotypes about Black women that just say they just don't want to do it.
So one of the things that it was interesting in reading that that also within our community, both the issue of the legacy of slavery, the legacy of the demonization of Black women and the sexual stereotypes also has led us to discourage breastfeeding. So there's that. It's sort of almost like internalizing oppression.
It is.
Right?
There's also, I think, with that, some mm-hmm. issues of safety. Because if you're going to full-on breastfeed, some of that is going to involve ever leaving your house and having to be in public spaces where you need to nurse. And I think just that is not as comfortable and safe for Black women as it is for white women and other women.
So what about the question then about working women? I mean, in other words, not everyone can take their child with them everywhere that they're going. So how does that factor in with this whole issue of formula, breastfeeding, et cetera?
Yeah, so our society makes it incredibly difficult if you want to breastfeed successfully, because just physically, when you're separated from the baby for any period of time, then the rhythm of the milk and the need and the demand kind of usually goes off. And so you would have to be able to pump when you're away for any significant period of time. And most employers make that incredibly difficult. Right. So even in the high end of work, you'll hear many stories. You'll see many lawsuits of people forced into the bathroom, not given, you know, spaces, not given places to refrigerate, all the things that you need. But when you're looking also at jobs where the person has no leverage, right, and they're just considered fungible by their employer, then there's not going to be any time off paid for the breaks to do it. It's not going to be at the time when you need it. And basically, work makes it impossible.
So returning to the quadruplets, so tell us more about what ends up happening with them.
Okay. So they lead very fascinating lives because they are celebrities. They go all over the country, they make appearances, they're famous in magazines, but on a personal level, they're always poor. The company gives them enough money so that they can have the clothes that they need for these appearances and shoots, but really not enough for basics. Their guardian has to appeal to people just to get them some toys. So they're always being pulled out of school, and they don't do well in school. So when they were first born, everyone was very excited and offering them scholarships and seeing this incredibly bright future. But as things played out over the years, and they were separated from their family, they weren't stable in school, things kind of declined. And eventually they went to college for a couple of years, and they were asked to leave. And they moved up to Peekskill, New York, where they tried to break into show business. They always loved music. They were very talented musicians and singers, but they never quite made it there either. And then by the age of 45, they were all diagnosed with breast cancer. So by 55, only one of the sisters was still alive, and she just died last year.
When you were researching this, how did you find out about them? And I think I remember you writing in a preface or something, or maybe it was an afterword, that that you actually did not speak with any of the sisters themselves. That was correct, right?
Yes, that's correct. So only Catherine was left. I came across their story while doing, I do a lot of research on milk and whiteness and its connections to white supremacy and like USDA policy around milk. And so in my milk research, it led me down the path of breast milk. And when doing that, I came across their story. And just like you, I felt very moved and fascinated and wanted to learn more. And so I started digging up whatever I could, and very little has been written about them. And so I started collecting archives of old newspapers and magazine articles about them. And I would try for a very, very long time to find someone from the family, and eventually found them on a Facebook group. And tried to sort of message them. They didn't want to answer, but then I posted some things on there, and I told them I was doing the research and asked if I could meet with them, but they said they didn't want to do that at that time, and so unfortunately I did not get the chance.
Now there's an international dimension to the larger story that I'd like you to speak a little bit about, that in, I believe it was in the 1970s, that there were issues that were being raised about the formula industry and its, what it was doing, particularly in the global South. And how does that relate to this story?
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. So Nestle was very famous for sort of being at the root of many deaths of babies, because of the mixing of contaminated water with formula. And despite that happening, the company, you know, pushing and selling their product. So there was an international boycott against them. And the parallels that I draw in the book are the exploitation that Nestle was doing of black and brown women across the globe, you know, while at home marketing to white people. And that's, of course, even more tragic because of the great scale of what happened there.
Yeah, I mean, there were all these deaths.
Yeah.
And it just, it's, I remember years ago reading elements of this, and that in some cases people believe that they had been actively poisoned because of the way that this whole matter was handled.
Yeah, it's terrible. Also that, you know, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, just to me, the complicity of the government and the way that it's still so intense. And last year with the United States stepping in trying to stop this resolution to promote breastfeeding globally at the World Health Assembly, mm-hmm. the United States threatened Ecuador with trade and aid sanctions if they didn't withdraw that.
And this was all because of the push of the formula industry, or was this ideological?
That's all it is. Uh-huh. It's just giving support to the industry. And that's at the expense of health.
We have just a few more minutes, but when I was reading this, I was also thinking about what are the implications of this story for the women's movement in the United States and for the labor movement in the United States? What would you say to leaders of both of those movements?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. That's a big question. So for when you say the women's movement, right, are we talking about black women, white women, like what kind of intersectional races? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because this is such an issue that is both race and feminist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so to anyone who's not thinking about it in those terms, they need to start, right? And really to have black women taking the lead on this. And the labor movement needs to get together with all those women and really try to restructure work so that feeding our infants, which is probably one of the most important things that we do, is not difficult. It's just a natural part of the day, right? So if that means a way, I mean, the ideal is for mothers or breastfeeding people to have access to their infants whenever they need them. So we need structures that we have, you know, kids on site at work or very close, and ways to get to them and just feed them when they need it and then get back, right? If we can't do that, we need universal, non-punitive ways to be able to pump milk at work, right? But there's a whole philosophy, there's a whole way of thinking about work that is antithetical to this and to just the idea of what people need, right? Mm-hmm. What babies need, what kids need, what parents need, what we all need as a society to function properly. They just don't go together. So I think there is a radical restructuring that is needed. But on the way, there are smaller steps that could be taken.
There's also one other thing that, I mean, you cover it in the book, and I think it's worth raising here, which is that there's this larger issue of birthing, the whole mm-hmm. process, and the issues like preeclampsia and other issues that black women are underdiagnosed and often ignored. And it seems to me that this also needs to become an issue that these two movements are pushing.
Absolutely. And these two are completely connected, right? Because so much of it is just about racist disregard of black women's needs. It's about racist medical treatment. It's about lack of training, right? It's about these underlying stereotypes and beliefs that make it impossible for healthcare providers to even see what black women need or listen to them.
Precisely. Well, Dr. Freeman, I want to thank you again very much for getting up very early or staying up late to join us. This has really been important to us, and I just want to thank you very, very much.
Well, I really appreciate your comments, and I hope that we can stay in conversation later because I would like to hear your thoughts about entertainment and marketing and all the things that you hinted at the beginning of the show.
Oh, I'll be in touch, definitely.
Excellent.
Sounds like a plan.
Good.
Thank you very much, and have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you. You too.
And that's Dr. Andrea Freeman, wrote a fabulous book called Skimmed, Breastfeeding Race and Injustice, published by Stanford University Press. I would definitely encourage you to read this. It's not only good just for what you will learn, but it is thought-provoking, and it's the kind of trigger that can be used in discussions in any number of settings. So please look for that book, Skimmed, Breastfeeding, Race, and Injustice by Dr. Andrea Freeman. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us once again on Arise. Hope you enjoyed today's program. I want to, of course, thank production assistants to Ngakia Kamara and engineering, Mike Nasella, without whom none of this would be possible. Thank you, the listeners, for joining us and for engaging with us today. And I look forward to reconnecting with you, of course, next Friday on WPFW Washington, D.C., 89.3 on the FM dial. Have a great weekend and take care.
Hello, it's that time of the year again, where we're having our 11th annual free Christmas Day dinner. That's WPFW 89.3 FM, along with Torres at Wilson's Restaurant at 700 V Street Northwest, directly across the street from Howard University Hospital. The Inner Voices and Your New Beginnings. We're presenting our 11th annual free Christmas Day dinner from 12 noon to 4 p.m. at Torres at Wilson, 700 V Street Northwest. Our free Christmas Day dinner will be broadcast live on WPFW 89.3 FM from 12 noon to 4 p.m. Come out and enjoy a free Christmas. WPFW is heard around the world. We are United Black Fund Memory Agency. The number to call is 202-526-4138. That's 202-526-4138. We need your help, support, and donations to make sure that our 11th annual free Christmas Day dinner is again another success. Thank you.
Among its other benefits, giving liberates the soul of the giver. The words of Dr. Maya Angelou. Thursday, December 26th through Tuesday, December 31st is your last opportunity to make a donation to WPFW for 2019. You can gift the WPFW listening experience by donating during our year-end pledge drive and can visit WPFWFM.org right now to do it. Your financial contribution allows WPFW to be heard by those who need the vital news, music, and perspective the station provides, but aren't able to donate. 89.3 FM is the gift that keeps on giving because of you since 1977. Give to WPFW now and liberate your soul.
WPFW and Bethesda Blues Jazz present a holiday fundraising bash not to be missed, featuring Nona Hendrix and her band, Mama Funk, Friday, December 20th at 8 p.m. At 6 p.m., WPFW's own DJs, Lance Reynolds and Carmen Spendiego, warm up the stage with soul funk sets. Hendrix's legendary career spans six decades of sound, beginning as a founding member of Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, to the Afro-futuristic stylings of LaBelle and beyond. Nona Hendrix remains the queen of transformation, still writing music across genres with politically and socially relevant lyrics wrapped in neo-funk grooves and soulful vocals. A holiday fundraising evening of music and message in support of WPFW with Nona Hendrix and Mama Funk that you won't want to miss. Tickets are $39.50 to $69.50, including a limited amount of VIP seating, which includes a champagne meet and greet with Nona Hendrix and Mama Funk. For tickets or information, visit bbjlive.com or call 240-330-4500. WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, serving the collective need and imagination of the community. Taking Action offers listeners current information about protecting our schools and communities by interviewing leaders in public housing development and educators. We share strategies to stand up for social justice, providing a voice for the homeless and those fighting against gentrification in our city, in addition to building our power as a community by supporting local businesses and holding government officials accountable.